finding that right group that has projections that make sense, that has a track record of success. And if they're buying something right now, they have a really good reason for buying it, because there's a lot of reasons not to buy stuff. And if somebody's buying right now, I would really want to see them having a really strong reason behind it.
Do you love your job, but want other investment options than your company's 401k and trying to pick stocks? If so, you've come to the right place. In this podcast, you will get actionable information for your passive real estate investment journey. Welcome back to another episode of Work Hard, Invest Harder podcast. Here's your host, Justin Dixon.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of the Work Hard, Invest Harder podcast. I am your host, Justin Dixon. And today we've got on the podcast a very experienced real estate investor and professional, Brian Burke. He is the president and CEO of Praxis Capital. He's been in the business for over 30 years. He has flipped over 700 houses early in his career. He's been in multifamily for over 20 years, acquiring over 4,000 units. So this podcast is chock filled with super information around both investing actively and passively in doing flips and multifamily syndications. We talk about the different markets that he's in and what he sees as the current market conditions, recording this in July of 2023. So let's get Brian on the pod. Brian, hey man, welcome to the podcast. Happy to have you on.
I'm just glad to be here, Justin. Thanks for asking me by.
Yeah, no worries. So why don't we jump right in? Give us a little bit of an overview of you and your journey. I know you've been doing real estate for a while. So kind of give us your intro and then we'll dig into some stuff.
Yeah, 34 years is a little while, I guess. I started as a house flipper and flipped about 700 and somewhere between 750 and 775 houses. I can't remember the exact number right now, but done a few, that's for sure. About 20 years ago, I got into multifamily and I started buying apartment complexes in several states across the country. So bought a little over 4,000 units during that time and recently sold about 3,000 of those 4,000 units. Wow.
So how did you get into it? Like what was the, and obviously you were a much younger person back 34 years ago, but how did you get exposure to real estate in general? And then, you know, let's talk about some flipping because you did a lot. So let's unpack that a little.
I was always trying to figure out how to make money. You know, as a kid, it's like, you know, you'd collect golf balls on the golf course and you sell them to the golfers as they cross the path from one street to one side to the other. So that was like probably my first business. And then I started selling books where you'd take book orders by mail and then you drop ship these books. And one of the books that was in there was a book on investing in real estate. And it was probably the worst real estate investing book ever written. But nevertheless, I figured it was my duty to read it if I was selling it. So I read the book and I'm like, oh, this is interesting. You know, my 20-year-old self is like, this says you can buy real estate with no money. And I have no money. You can buy real estate if you don't know what you're doing. And I don't know what I'm doing.
For you, I guess, at that point.
It was the perfect, it was speaking to me. So it was the perfect book. So I decided I might as well get into investing in real estate. What else am I going to do?
Yeah, no, that's awesome. So you had an entrepreneurial kind of bug early on in your life, it sounds like, selling golf balls and books and probably doing drop shipping before drop shipping was actually a term back in the day. Where were you doing all these flips? Like talk about kind of the journey into flipping.
Yeah, I started doing them right here in my own backyard. I live in Northern California, north of San Francisco. So these are in the San Francisco Bay Area. And yeah, I mean, I just did whatever I could to try to get deals and finance them. And that was the tricky part because I didn't have any money. So the first deal I bought, I got it for no money down. I got a finance company to finance like 80% of the deal. And then I got the seller to finance the rest of the down payment. So I didn't have to come up with any money out of pocket to buy it and then fix it up and rented it out and then sold it a couple of years later. And then the next deal was like, I'd apply for every credit card offer that came in the mail. And I had this whole stack of credit cards. So I took them all to the bank. I handed them to the teller and I said, cash advance them all to the max. And they look at me like I was robbing the bank. They did it and they handed me a cashier's check. And that's how I bought my second one. And then I just kept, you know, doing anything and everything I could
to get more experience. Leveraging to the hilt credit cards and all of that, making every penny count to buying deals. And obviously flipping is very active, right? You've got to be always hunting for the next deal. And it's very cash flow heavy in the sense that you get a lot of cash unless you flip them or long-term flip more of a buy and hold, then you get the appreciation. But what was going on in Northern California at that point? Was it kind of the 01, 02 at this point, I guess?
Late 1990s. Yeah. Okay. Late 1990s to the early 2000s during that period. And there was really nothing going on. I mean, the dot-com bubble hit in 2000 and then caused stocks to tank. But real estate was just kind of, you know, doing what real estate does. I figured out early on that the best way for me to be successful and make money consistently in real estate was to buy at a discount. The best way to buy at a discount was to find foreclosed real estate. Mm. And so I focused all my efforts on distressed property and foreclosed real estate. And I think that was probably one of the best moves I could have made.
So what does that mean when you kind of focus on how do you find foreclosed real estate, like to somebody that's not aware? And I'm not a single family person, so I'm kind of curious, kind of, is that something that's still a viable option today?
It is. In fact, I've sold two flips recently. If you can believe it, I still have a team that does house flips for me. And we actually just sold two houses and made, almost 170 grand on two flips. So it's still a viable strategy. It's certainly not to the quantity that I was getting after the great financial collapse when we were buying 100 houses a year. So it's certainly nothing like that. But I started out doing letters to homeowners and postcards to homeowners and that kind of stuff, and quickly learned that strategy didn't work very well, especially for me. I just didn't have the right things to say. And plus, I looked like I was 16 years old and nobody's going to sell their house to some 16-year-old. So I decided that the only way I was going to be able to do this would be to go buy at the courthouse steps, because nobody can say no. So I would look for foreclosure sale notices. I'd show up at the courthouse steps and bid on properties that were being auctioned off.
Got it. So how did you come up with capital to buy 100 houses a year? That seems like a lot of, or was it kind of you're just buying, flipping, and you were kind of just using the proceeds to kind of scale that?
Yeah, we were buying and flipping, that's for sure. But when you're doing 100 houses in the San Francisco Bay Area, even in the midst of the great financial collapse, you're talking about, you know, $20 million or more in houses and inventory at any given time. I think at one point we had 50 houses just in various stages of construction, each house costing somewhere between $100,000 and $400,000 generally. So it definitely is very capital intensive. So I was raising money left and right through blind pool funds where investors would invest in the fund. We didn't have real estate in the fund. They would just invest blindly. And then I would have discretionary authority over that capital to make whatever purchases that I saw met the fund's criteria. The old other people's money strategy.
Yeah. And how did you, I guess, get people comfortable with investing in a blind fund? If, I guess, did you have a lot of track record at that point so you can kind of show proof of concept? Or did you just know a bunch of rich people that were like, hey, here's some money you can go hang out with?
Yeah. Boy, I wish I knew no one. So when I started this business, it was late 1990s and I was doing, you know, a couple dozen houses a year by my fifth or sixth year. But when I was doing 100 houses a year, that was like 2009, 10, 11, 12 during that period, and produced a lot of good results. Almost 10 years of track record, or actually a little more than 10 years of track record by that time.
Yeah.
Well, house prices just fell by 70%. And it's like, exactly. That's why we're buying them, is because they fell by 70%. And I could just convince enough people that it was the right thing to do and just raise money $100,000 at a time. Yeah. Just kind of the hard way.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. I wish I had the real estate mind or mindset back in 08, because I graduated college 06. So I didn't have obviously a lot of capital in 08. But yeah, the housing crisis really caused me to be more weary than see it as a buying opportunity. Whereas right now, we're kind of in this high interest rate environment. So could this be the right buying opportunity? Still kind of TBD, I think, at the moment. But I want to kind of talk a little bit about kind of your transition from flipping into the multifamily space, but we're going to take a quick sponsor break. We'll be right back.
Whether you're in a job you love or hate, building a financial foundation is important. This foundation can support you by providing passive income, stability in an uncertain economy, or the launching pad for you to start your own business. Great Venture Capital helps busy professionals invest in commercial real estate to build passive income streams, grow wealth, and take advantage of tax benefits. If you'd like to learn more, check us out at greatventurecapital.com or send an email to justin@greatventurecapital.com.
All right, we are back on the Work Hard, Invest Harder podcast. We've got Brian Burke, and we started talking about all the flips that you were doing early in your career, but you mentioned that you owned at one point over 4,000 units in the multifamily space. So you've always done flipping, it sounds like. You still have a team that does it for you, but when did you start dipping your toe into the multifamily space?
It was about 20 years ago. I was looking around and realizing, like, I set this goal. I thought if I buy one house a year for the rest of my career, I'll retire pretty well. Yeah. And at some point I finally realized, like, wait a minute, why do I want to buy one house a year and have all these houses scattered all over the place? What if I could just buy multi-units? And I knew nothing about it. And so I got together with the real estate agent that was selling some of my flips. He was a CCIM, which is a commercial real estate broker designation. And I said, hey, you know, I'm interested in this whole multifamily thing. I don't know how it works. I don't know how to read these income statements or what I should look for. And he's like, come on to the office. I'll show you what you need to know. So I sat down with him. He spent a bunch of time with me showing me the ropes. And I'm like, this is the way. I need to start buying more multifamily. So I did a 1031 exchange. I sold two rental houses that I had. And I used the proceeds of those two rental houses in that 1031 and bought a 16-unit apartment building. That was the first time I'd ever owned apartment units. And then from there, I kind of never really looked back. I just started doing that more and more. And then after the great financial collapse, and I was doing all these flips, buying 100 houses a year and all that, and raising all this money from people. And I'm like thinking, you know, these foreclosures are going to vanish, right? I mean, right now I'm drinking from a fire hose, but in 2 or 3 years, all these foreclosures are going to be washed through the system. We're not going to have this buying opportunity. And yet I've got all these investors that love investing with me. What am I going to do with all this capital?
Yeah.
So I figured, you know, why not buy more multifamily and put that money to work? Cause that's more scalable. It's like you can buy a house that's maybe $1 million, but you could buy an apartment building for $100 million. So I could definitely put a lot more money to work if I transitioned to multi. So I made that commitment about 20 years ago and never looked back.
And what size apartment complexes were you typically targeting?
In the very beginning, it was small stuff. I bought a 16 unit, a 10 unit. I bought fourplexes. I bought duplexes. And then finally worked my way up and bought a 60 unit. And then after the 60 unit, I bought a 54 unit and then 136 unit. And now pretty much anything under 100 units is a non-starter. Yep. Most of the stuff we're doing now is 100 to 250 units. So the largest I've done is 540 units.
Got it. You mentioned that the flips are all mostly in the Northern California area. Where are you looking at multifamily for? Same areas?
No, not California at all. I don't like California real estate. For flipping, it's one thing because it's an arbitrage play, right? Buy low, sell high quickly, get in, get out. But multifamily is a commitment. You're going to own that for a while. And I want to own that in a place where we're going to be welcomed. So I don't invest in California, but Arizona, Texas, Georgia, Florida, I've owned in all those states. I own in Alabama. I've been looking to own, but haven't yet struck in the Carolinas and Tennessee and a bunch of other southeastern markets.
Got it. So you're kind of hitting the Sun Belt like every other syndicator, it seems like, that is going after everything below the 29th parallel, which is where everybody seems to be moving to.
Absolutely right.
It's over 100 degrees in late July in Texas, and I grew up in the Northeast, so less humid, but just super hot down
here. Maybe I should be investing in an air conditioning business instead.
Air conditioning and pool service, because we've had terrible pool service people here in Austin. At least the first one was bad. But anyway, we can talk about that offline. So you've started buying a bunch of real estate, and then I'm assuming you have a team, right? So obviously, multifamily real estate is a team sport. You've got to have people, obviously, with money. You obviously were raising capital for that. You obviously have to, you know, have people finding deals and all of that stuff. So at what point did you start kind of realizing, okay, this is a business and I need to build a team around me that can take all the other pieces of the puzzle off of my plate and kind of spread the wealth around, if you will?
Yeah, it was an interesting organic growth process and time with a little bit of luck mixed in. So it started building after we were heavy into all these house flips out here in California. My partner in that business, who was a longtime production home builder, he had asked me like, hey, I heard you're investing in apartment buildings. I'm like, yeah. And he goes, we should do more of that. So I'm like, let's go look at Texas and see if we can buy something out there. So he started going to Texas to go look at property. And then next thing you know, we bought something. Then he's out there managing the crews. And then he'd be back out there to check on the property manager. Next thing I know, he's moved to Texas, moved to Austin, right there in your hometown. So we started buying a lot of stuff in Austin, Dallas, and Houston. And we built a pretty decent portfolio there. And I'm like, you know, I really need to expand outside of Texas and go to more areas. But the resources that we have, I'm just not sure how I'm going to make that work. And right as I was trying to figure all that out, a guy just randomly calls me and says, you know, he was a friend of one of the guys that used to help me out with my house flips in California, believe it or not. This guy had come from the institutional space, multifamily institutional space.
Yeah.
And him and two other guys had long careers, over 100,000 units of experience between the three of them. And they were like, you know, we're looking for a new opportunity. We want to be more entrepreneurial, get out of the corporate rat race. And my friend suggested I call you. And I'm like, it's funny you say that because I'm trying to figure out how I'm going to grow my portfolio. As it turns out, these guys had experience in like 40 of the 50 states, right? So now instead of calling a broker, they're like, oh, what experience do you have in Atlanta? It's like, well, none. Now I could say, well, our team has 11,000 units of experience in Atlanta, and it's a totally different conversation. So that's really what helped propel the business to a more national scale, was just getting the right team behind me that had experience in a lot of areas.
Yeah, it's interesting. Sometimes when you think about, you know, things that you want to do in your business or life, opportunities present themselves, right? They kind of just manifest right there. And that's kind of the same situation. You're kind of like, hey, how do I build a team? And you get a phone call. And
their team comes to you. Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's the weirdest thing. Yeah, that movie, The Secret, you know, it's actually true. I mean, if you, you think about where you want to go, and somehow or another, the universe makes it happen for you. At least it did for me.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. And so what's your situation right now? You mentioned that you recently sold off a bunch of units, 3/4 of your unit count, it sounds like. Obviously, fortuitous timing, selling them in kind of early 2022 before rates really started to shoot up there. So what's the operations look like right now?
Yeah, we got just under 1,000 units still in our book. All of it is Class A properties in really good submarkets in good neighborhoods with kind of strong schools and that sort of stuff. So we did a flight to quality. We started buying higher quality stuff a few years ago. And when we sold off, the only thing we kept was our highest quality assets. And so now it just, the business looks like operate the hell out of what you got.
Yeah.
And wait for a better market to come by to start building that portfolio back up. But it was really good to get that exit because, you know, as a real estate syndicator, you make money really two ways. You make money off of fees for finding deals and getting financing put together and getting the deal closed. And you make money by performing really well and selling at a massive profit and getting a split of that profit.
Yep.
So it was really nice to get some sales to line our pockets for a while, at least long enough to get us through until we start buying again, because I don't think we're going to be buying for a while.
Yeah, I wanted to kind of transition the crystal ball situation. Obviously, it sounds like you haven't purchased anything in the last over a year now, it seems like.
Year and a half.
Yeah. Are you seeing this now as rates seem to have, like, I don't want to say leveled off, because there's always talk about potentially going a little higher, but are you seeing this right now as a buying opportunity, given that there is going to be a lot of the variable rate debt, the bridge debt that typically is the 2 to 3 year time horizon is going to be coming due, whether you're trying to refinance that or some people won't be able to just from a debt service ratio standpoint. But what are you seeing as, like, is this like the time to start buying right now or not yet?
I don't think we're there yet. I think it's setting us up for a buying opportunity. I don't think the buying opportunity is really here yet. I think if we were real about what values are, there could be some good buys to be made, but I don't think anybody's really come to terms with where values are. Sellers certainly haven't, you know, sellers and myself included, I'm a property owner. I don't want to sell at what the properties are probably really worth today.
Yeah.
So there's this big bid ask spread where there's almost a total halt in deal flow because buyers think properties are worth a fraction of what sellers think properties are worth, which is a fraction higher than they're really worth. And so as a result, nothing is really getting done. I don't see a buying opportunity yet, but eventually sellers are going to get pushed into a corner, especially the ones that have really bad financing terms. When they get loan maturities and the lenders are increasingly difficult to work with, they don't really have any kind of way to get out of the situation they've painted themselves into. Then there's going to be some opportunities to buy. And when will that be? I don't know. I think 6 months, a year, 2 years, I wouldn't be surprised at any of those answers, but I can't call it yet.
Yeah. And are you still, like, your team, like, underwriting deals still? Because obviously I look every once in a while and I think just what you said, like, there's still a delta between what sellers are asking for and potentially what reality is, or at least what I think reality is from a value perspective. Are they still underwriting deals and they're just obviously not finding ones that make sense? Or have you kind of said, hey, let's just pause on all of that?
We did a pause back in early 2022. We completely shut off our underwriting flow in early 22. We actually started underwriting again in late 22, early 23.
Yeah.
And, you know, now we're underwriting, but we're really only underwriting for the purposes of having our fingers on the pulse of the market. We don't underwrite anything because we think we're going to get the deal, or maybe even because we think we're going to write an offer. We just want to see, you know, how close are we getting to the broker's pricing guidance? What happens to the broker's pricing guidance after 30, 60 or 90 days? Or has the deal actually sold? And if it did sell, what did it sell for? What was the buyer profile? And, you know, it's all this is just gathering intel so that we can kind of better predict when it's actually going to be time to strike. If you're not involved in the market, you don't know the market. And if you don't know the market, you shouldn't be in the market.
Yeah, no, I agree. I'm in a slow underwriting phase at the moment, just kind of to your point, keeping tabs on values. And if I'm getting closer to something that pencils and actually looks like a good potential deal, what point, like, I guess some of my audience are more kind of the passive investor. They have a job, they're, you know, self-employed, they make good money, but they want to find other options outside of just the stock market and their company 401k. If somebody hasn't invested passively in a deal, what's some advice you would potentially give them to find a good operator like yourself that they can put 50, 100 grand with, feel as comfortable as possible, that's going to come back to them with some friends in a year or in a few years?
Well, it all comes out of that sponsor's track record and their integrity and their moral character. There's a lot of factors surrounding that. In fact, I wrote a 350-page book that essentially is written to tell passive investors how to invest in passive real estate offerings, because it really is that complex. They call it passive investments, but really you're selecting the sponsors, anything but passive. That's a very active process, and you have to decide who you want to invest with. After that, you can get passive. So it's really about finding that right group that has projections that make sense, that has a track record of success. And if they're buying something right now, they have a really darn good reason for buying it, because there's a lot of reasons not to buy stuff. And if somebody's buying right now, I would really want to see them having a really strong reason behind it.
Yeah, I can attest that the book is good. I own it, actually, The Hands-Off Investor, Insider's Guide to Investing in Passive Real Estate Syndications. So it was one of the books that I kind of helped me on my initial journey when I got started in this game 5 years ago. So definitely excited to have you on the podcast. So I appreciate the wisdom that you put out in that book. So if anybody hasn't read it, I definitely highly recommend it. I'm assuming it's still out there and available in Amazon and all the other stores and all that. So track record is one thing, I guess. There's a million and one syndicators out there, right? And social media makes everybody look like they're rock stars and they're buying houses and apartments and flips and whatever they want to do. So how do you kind of sift through some of the noise, make sure that you're finding the right person? Obviously, if they can show you, hey, we bought X, Y, and Z deals and here is the actual returns. But some of it is a little bit of, you have to have the right personality and the right culture fit and all of that. So are there any other pointers you can maybe give around or knowledge that they need to get as a passive investor? Because like you said, passive investing isn't as passive as people think, at least in the front end, right? You've got to be able to at least understand some of the lingo and jargon around multifamily or whatever asset class, frankly, that you're getting into.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I look for, because I'm a passive investor as well as an active investor too. You know, I invest in other deals as well. And one of the things I look for is I want to see that they've been through a market cycle and survived that market cycle and kind of see what happened during that market cycle, you know, that adverse market cycle, right? Yeah. So I've been doing this now for 34 years. I've never lost a dime of investors' principal. And I've been through some really, really bad markets.
Yeah.
So, you know, that to me says a lot, right? Yeah. It also says, also you want somebody that is fairly well known. I mean, if they're a complete unknown, then they don't really have any skin in the game from the sense that they could totally raid the corporate coffers and take all the money and disappear, leave the deal hanging, go into foreclosure, and then pop back up in a year with a different company name, a new flag, and a new logo, and start all over again and do it again, versus somebody that has a well-known name could never get away with that. Like, I could never do that, because, you know, we'd come back and they'd be like, oh, that's the guy that blah, blah, blah. Right? It's like somebody that's been around a while, really, if they've been able to last that long, it's because they're doing something right. So I want to see somebody that's been around the block a while, and preferably someone that's actually been through an adverse market cycle and survived it. Those are some big things that I'd be looking for.
No, that's actually really interesting. I haven't thought about the adverse piece of it, because the market, if you bought a deal in 2018, 19 and sold it in 21, you would look like a rock star because everything went up into the right. Rents went up into the right. Cap rates actually went down, compressed, which is good. So, which is interesting. And so I guess the thing I was thinking about is, if you don't have that track record, if you haven't been through an adverse cycle and you are trying to raise money, what do you think is like some good advice to the other side of the coin when you're trying to build that track record and you want to do this as a full-time gig or even maybe three quarters of a time gig? How do you kind of build enough credibility to raise the money necessary to take down some of these bigger deals?
You have somebody on your team or your advisory board that has that experience and knowledge that can bring some of that level-headedness, so to speak, into the equation, because it's very easy to be exuberant or irrational exuberance in the earlier part. I mean, I remember the first 10 years I was in real estate, I felt like a kid in a candy store. After a while of doing this, you actually feel more like a long-tailed cat in a room full of rocking chairs. And that's really the guy you want investing your money, or at least you want to have somebody on their team that thinks that way, because this isn't really a kid in a candy store situation. Real estate is kind of like a loaded gun. It can save your life or it could kill you, depend upon how it's used. And you want somebody that understands that and treats it with the respect it deserves, because you're absolutely right. I mean, if you timed it right, even a robot could have made a ton of money in multifamily real estate, depending on when they got in and when they got out.
Yeah. And one thing that I see is kind of the flavor of the 2023 year is kind of, I've been calling it the year of the operator, because a lot of deals aren't selling, you know, the market isn't bailing out bad deals or you overpaid or whatever. What are some of the things that you do from an operational standpoint and an asset management standpoint to, one, communicate to your investors, good than bad and the ugly, right? Because obviously, if I'm an investor, I'd rather know bad news than no news. But what are some of the other operational things that you do when you do take it over an asset and maybe there are some hiccups throughout that renovation or hold period?
The first thing you have to do is always communicate with your investors what's going on. I mean, if it's bad news, good news, whatever, just tell people what it is. I mean, a lot of times people have this hesitancy to share bad news because they think, oh, our investors are going to think we're idiots. It's like, no, your investors probably have deals with other sponsors too and are seeing the same thing. And now what they're doing is they're comparing how you're doing with how they're doing. They're comparing how you're communicating versus how their other sponsors are communicating. So the bad news is out there and they already know it. If you're not saying it and their other sponsors are, it's not going to make you look good. So it's really important to keep people apprised of what's going on. But really, the success or failure of a deal, in my opinion, the success or failure is written on the wall before the deal ever closes on the purchase. Because if you finance this thing with 90% LTV, high leverage, short maturity, bridge debt, with risky and lofty projections, the thing is doomed for failure. I don't care how good of an operator you might turn out to be. If the market turns against you and that rising tide doesn't lift your boat, you're gonna sink.
Yeah.
One of the things that we've always prided ourselves in addition to having a really strong operational team that really knows what they're doing, but is to structure the deal properly going in. We tend to use lower leverage debt with longer maturities so that we have a lot of extra cash flow that when things aren't going well, we can absorb that. I mean, we may have to cut off distributions, but we don't have to hand the property back to the bank. That's the way we try to set ourselves up. And it's kind of like, if you look back to 08, the people that got foreclosed and failed were the people that had way too much debt. And the ones that got through it were the ones that didn't.
Yeah. Now that we're recording this in late July 23, obviously it sounds like you guys have been kind of on a pause from a buying perspective in the multifamily space, doing still some flips, it sounds like. Are there any other asset classes or anything else that you're looking into now that you have the time to kind of pick your head up and see what other asset classes or anything out that's out there?
Not really. I've kind of already been there and done that and got that t-shirt, you know, and 20 years ago, I'd done everything. I'd built self-storage, resort hotel, you know, developed single family. I did land development and subdividing. And I mean, I've kind of tried everything and realized that it seems like every time I stray out of my lane, I get sideswiped. It's a lot easier for me to just kind of stick to the lane where I found that we're really good at. And if I don't see any opportunity there, I can just wait it out. So I'm more in that mode. I'd say in terms of asset classes and kind of getting into that kind of different strategies, one thing we are doing, which is a bit of a departure, kind of not, is we're buying real estate debt. So we've launched a debt fund and we're actually acquiring bridge notes that are made to real estate investors for the purposes of flipping houses and apartment buildings and that sort of stuff. Shorter term bridge debt. We're buying up some of that just because for me, it's kind of twofold. One is you mentioned earlier about investors, you know, wanted to keep them interested and they need a place to invest their money and they're looking, where do we go? I don't like stocks. Yeah. I want to be in real estate. This allows people a way to stay in the real estate game. It's cash flow day one versus like, you know, value add multi where it's cash flow day 400.
Right.
It's more immediate and somebody else's money is in first loss position. And with today's risk profile, that's really where I'd rather be. And we're going to do that for a while. And eventually the real estate market will have a new flavor and we'll find a new strategy of getting back in.
Yeah. I'm also always curious kind of people that have done it for a long time. Like what kind of keeps you motivated? Like what's your why about like the real estate game and continuing to do this for 30 plus years?
Well, I've got a lot of investors that depend on me to perform for them. And, you know, we've got thousands of investors that have invested hundreds of millions of dollars with us. And I look at them as a partner and a service provider, and I want to do a good job for them. And plus I enjoy real estate. What the heck else am I going to do?
No, that's fair. I mean, that's totally fair. It's been amazing. I want to kind of wrap this up the way I wrap everything up. I've got a 3-pack of questions that I ask every guest. So what's one piece of advice that got you started or helped you on your real estate investing journey?
Gosh, I didn't take a whole lot of advice. I thought I was the Lone Ranger back in the day. So I just kind of tried to do everything on my own. But I think probably one of the best pieces of advice I got was from a large, longtime real estate investor. I asked him, I said, what was the one thing that made the biggest difference in your life and business? And he said it was when institutions came in. He said, when I started getting money from institutional investors, that changed everything. I thought that was really interesting because it talked a lot about scale and about how building a business to attract large amounts of capital is what really will be the most personally rewarding.
Yeah, if you can raise 100 million from institution versus 100,000 from one person, you know, it takes a little longer for the institution, but once you get that big check, it's there for you to kind of go do with. So that makes a lot of sense. This may be biased and you can mention your own book, but what's your favorite real estate or business book that you're into right now?
Gosh, I hate this answer because I haven't read many books in a long, long time. And when I do read a book, I rarely read a real estate book. That's a really difficult question to answer just because I don't have enough recent experience with any books to be able to give any really good solid advice. There was a couple of books I liked. They were more business related books. One was called Real Leaders Don't Do PowerPoint. It was just a book on how to give presentations and people interested in presentations. I mean, that's a lot of what we do, right? Is presenting or getting our idea across. That was really cool. Kind of related to that, there was a book from the writer, the guy that is in charge of the TED organization. It was called TED Talks. And it was all about how the TED Talks are structured and kind of why they work so well. And kind of how to do one. I thought that was really interesting to learn. So one of the interesting pieces of advice in that book was that the shorter your presentation, the longer it takes you to prepare for it. Mm. And I thought that was really, really interesting because if you've got to get a point across in very few words, you really have to refine your message. And I thought that was really, really cool advice. And I don't know, just something you don't see very often.
Yeah, no, because obviously we're trying to, you know, explain a complex real estate transaction in a handful of slides, and we're trying to do it as fast as possible with as much useful detail as possible. So that's definitely a useful skill if you can get your point across in a short amount of time. All right, last question here is, if you hit your financial freedom number, meaning you could live an amazing life just off of the passive income that you are generating from real estate, what would you do?
If I could hit that, what would I do? That's a good question. I'd probably spend a little bit more time traveling. Not that I don't spend enough of that already, because this year has been a lot of travel, but there's a lot of places I haven't seen I would like to go see. I'd probably do an African safari and I don't know, just go to Italy and do a bunch of crazy stuff.
No, I like it. I like it. Italy is on the kind of top three of my wife and I's kind of next trip list. So definitely have Italy as a top one. So
mine too. Maybe I'll see you there.
There you go. We should plan a trip and look at some real estate, maybe buy a winery out there or something like that. So
there you go.
There we go. Brian, really appreciate you being on the podcast. It's been amazing. How can people reach out to you? What's the best way to connect with you if they want to learn more about what you're doing?
The best way is through our company website. Praxis Capital's website. It's praxcap.com. It's praxcap.com. You could also connect with me on Instagram. You could follow me at Investor Brian Burke. You can check out the book, The Hands-Off Investor. It's available on Amazon or at biggerpockets.com/syndication book.
Awesome. That stuff in the show notes. So people can just click links and be off and running. Brian, man, really appreciate the time.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me here, Justin. It's been fun.
Thanks.
I hope you got value out of this episode of the Work Hard, Invest Harder podcast, your one-stop shop for education on how you can continue to work hard in your career and have different options to invest even harder. If you took anything away from this episode, please like and comment. I read every comment as it helps me serve you better. Make sure to subscribe and hit the notification bell. That way you won't miss out on more valuable content. If you're watching this video, it means that you want to grow your passive real estate portfolio. The easiest way to do that is to join our investor club by heading to greatventurecapital.com/invest. The link is in the show notes. See you on the next episode.